Welcome to the deep dive. This is your comprehensive, exhaustive, and detailed review of the most critical news and intelligence of the day, all pulled directly from our source material.
Today, we are focusing our deep dive on the key insights from the Wall Street Journal for Friday, December 26th, 2025.
I'm Alex Vanderbilt, your host guide, and I am joined, as always, by Sam Astor, our expert in synthesizing these, well, these intricate connections between finance, technology, and global policy.
Alex, it's a pleasure to be here. And we have a really powerful set of interlocking narratives today.
It seems that way.
Yeah, it paints a very complex picture of a world where, you know, massive concentrated wealth is operating in the shadows, where infrastructure bottlenecks are, believe it or not, slowing the fastest technological revolution in history.
And at the same time, geopolitical flashpoints are intensifying everywhere, from the Himalayas to the Middle East.
Exactly. Our mission, as always, is to provide you, the listener, with the clearest, most synthesized understanding of what truly matters in this rapid flow of information.
Absolutely. We're here to cut through the noise and give you the signal. We'll start, as is our tradition, with a necessary look at the financial environment, just to get a snapshot of the closing numbers.
Right.
Wednesday, even though it was a holiday-shortened session, saw U.S. stocks rise. It's really continuing that year-end momentum,
pushing both the S&P 500 and the Dow to new record highs.
Incredible.
And that that enthusiasm wasn't just confined to New York. If you look across Asia on Thursday, Japan's Nikkei edged up just a bit, 0.1%. The Shanghai Composite rose 0.6%. So the capital flow remains pretty strong. I think it's fueled by optimism around corporate earnings and just, you know, continued momentum in tech.
So to give everyone the specific context of where we stand, can you just walk us through those key closing price points?
Certainly. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 48731.16.
And the NASDAQ Q, always so tech heavy.
Right. The NASDAQ Q finished at 23613.31.
Yeah.
We also saw movement in fixed income with the 10-year Treasury yield closing at 4.133%.
What about commodities?
Oil settled at $58.35. And gold. Gold is reflecting this ongoing global uncertainty and inflation fears. It continued its remarkable ascent.
Closing
at $480.60 per ounce.
Those stock indices, they reflect incredible corporate health, but that optimistic picture, it gets complicated almost immediately when we dig into our first major theme.
It really does.
Which is this new face of financial power and a really accelerating economic divide. The wealth is concentrating faster than ever, and its operational structures are, well, they're moving outside of traditional visibility.
We're talking about the explosive rise of the family office.
Exactly.
And the insight here isn't just that the ultra-rich are getting richer. I mean, we know that. It's that they're building a parallel, almost unregulated financial system that operates entirely outside of traditional visibility and, crucially, risk assessment.
And the growth metrics are.
Huh.
They're just stunning.
They are.
Deloitte estimates that the total wealth overseen by these highly secretive firms is projected to rise to $6.9 trillion this year.
And that's just this year. They expect that figure to top $9 trillion by 2030.
That is a massive 67% jump from just 5 years ago when they managed around $5.5 trillion.
Which means they will soon manage more money than all hedge fund firms combined.
The comparison to hedge funds is so critical here, isn't it?
It is, because it highlights this massive transfer of power. You know, hedge funds are regulated, they're publicly scrutinized, they have to report their holdings, their risk exposure.
But family offices.
Family offices, on the other hand, operate with almost zero public transparency. No real regulatory oversight compared to, say, a public pension fund or a traditional asset manager. They answer only to the family they serve.
And their scope of operations just underscores how integrated they are into the lives of the super rich. It's so much more than just investment.
Oh, absolutely. These offices are the centerpieces of these families' financial and, you know, personal lives.
Handling everything from paying thousands of personal bills, managing staff for global estates.
Selecting private toys. We're talking jets, yachts. They even employ specialized services like psychologists and art advisors.
It's become the new status symbol. Launching a single family office is the latest mark of financial arrival, even for families with, and I'm putting this in quotes, only hundreds of millions.
Right. And the operational flexibility this structure provides, it gives them a huge investment advantage.
How so?
Because they aren't bound by quarterly investor demands or the need to generate immediate liquidity. They have this vast latitude to hold investments for decades. They can ride out volatility that would force a traditional fund to sell.
Which allows them to make these massive, concentrated wagers that institutional investors just can't touch.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And we're also seeing this new dynamic where they are clubbing together for major deals. They're moving in packs.
And this collective power, it means they can now compete directly against private equity behemoths. You're talking about firms like Apollo and Blackstone.
The competition is very real. I mean, look at the $6 billion merger deal involving the fusion energy firm, TAE Technologies, and Trump Media and Technology Group.
Who was behind that?
Well, backers of TAE included the family offices of figures like the late Pequot Capital founder Arthur Sandberg and Addison Fisher. Their long-term patient capital makes them profoundly attractive sources of funding.
Especially since they often avoid hedging through derivatives, right?
Exactly. It simplifies the deal structure for the underlying company. It just confirms that the entire wealth structure is shifting, concentrating both financial power and operational secrecy in fewer, less visible hands.
So we have this incredible, almost invisible concentration of financial power in the family offices. And this, it just fuels our next topic directly.
It does.
This dramatic divergence between the super rich's Wall Street economy and the struggles facing Main Street.
That is the crucial insight. We are absolutely seeing two different economic realities.
For the big guys.
For giant, well-capitalized corporations. You know, your Amazons, your NVIDIAs, the S&P 500, it has been a stellar year. It's been driven by surging profits and this AI enthusiasm propelling stocks to record highs. Net income for S&P 500 companies was up nearly 13% year over year in the third quarter.
But if the stock market is doing so well, what does that tell us about the majority of the economy? Specifically small businesses, which employ nearly half the U.S. workforce.
It tells you that the benefits of the boom are not being evenly distributed. Not at all. Small businesses are facing these structural challenges that big companies can just easily absorb.
Their margins are thinner?
Much thinner. Their cash reserves are smaller, and you have years of high inflation, cautious consumers, and these lingering tariffs.
Yeah.
It's all weighing heavily on their earnings.
We see that pain so clearly in the job data.
We do.
Payroll processor ADP reported that private firms with fewer than 50 workers have been steadily shedding jobs. They cut 120,000 in November alone.
And you compare that to large and mid-sized firms, which are continuing to add positions. The divergence is just, it's stark.
And we have some painful, concrete examples of this distress.
Yeah, these anecdotes really bring it to life. Take Sydney Rieckhoff. She's the CEO of Almost Famous Popcorn in Iowa.
What's her story?
They typically hire 10 to 15 seasonal workers for the holiday rush.
Yeah.
This year, they only brought on 4 or 5.
And why?
She attributed the slump to more thoughtful spending from corporate clients. So that suggests that even B2B orders are tightening up.
And tariffs, specifically on imported goods, they continue to act as this significant, unpredictable tax on small retailers.
A huge tax. Randy Vines, he's the co-owner of STL Style, an apparel shop in St. Louis. He called the combination of a week prior holiday season and tariffs the double whammy.
He even called it the nail in the coffin.
He did. They proactively cut staff hours by 25% and just avoided hiring entirely this year, simply to survive.
And the complexity of international trade is also sinking smaller firms that rely on it. Total Promotion Co. in Las Vegas cut their staff from 10 down to 6.
Their challenge was, well, it was confusion over tariffs on imported promotional merchandise. The company would often get these unexpected bills for tariffs after the fact.
Which means they were losing money on jobs they thought were profitable.
Right. The lack of clarity just makes risk management impossible for a small operation.
And in high-cost metro areas, these pressures are just compounded by local factors.
Oh, absolutely. Look at Zach Nagin, the owner of Tabula Rasa Bar in Los Angeles. He cited soaring costs for labor, rent, insurance, plus all those tariffs on imported goods like wine and cheese.
And on top of that, you layer on local crises, wildfires, the entertainment industry slowdown.
He was forced to shorten worker shifts and halt replacement hiring. He admitted he has less confidence in the direction of things than at any point in his 10 years running the bar.
This business divide, it's just perfectly mirrored in the consumer landscape.
It is. The Federal Reserve's latest anecdote compilation noted that overall consumer spending declined further. But higher-end retail spending remained resilient. The growth is all concentrated. The nation's top 10% of earners account for nearly half of all national spending.
So if Main Street is suffering, what is fueling the U.S. economy's ability to defy all those recession warnings we heard earlier this year?
It boils down to those two key drivers we mentioned. First, concentrated household consumption from higher-income Americans whose wealth is amplified by the stock market boom.
And second,
and massive business investment in AI infrastructure. Economists noted that high-end consumption and corporate investment in data centers and supporting scaffolding accounted for nearly 70% of total growth in the third quarter.
So the economy is powering ahead, but it's doing so on a very narrow high-altitude foundation.
Exactly. The truly bifurcated economy is booming for the biggest players and the wealthiest consumers, but it's increasingly challenging and fragile for everyone else.
This sets the stage beautifully for our next segment. From Main Street's fight for survival, we shift back to Wall Street, where the largest financial players are seeking to manage massive pools of money by imitating, and perhaps dangerously misapplying, a strategy perfected by Warren Buffett.
The imitation game here, it centers on the search for float. As you know, Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway maintains its vast investing empire by using the cash or float from insurance premiums it holds before claims are paid out.
It's essentially interest-free seed capital.
That's the key. It's interest-free.
A model that sounds ideal. And we've seen private equity giants like Apollo, KKR, and Blackstone buying up insurance companies explicitly to capture that float.
They have. Apollo's CEO, Mark Rowan, he even cited elements of Berkshire Hathaway when his firm merged with its insurance affiliate, Athene, a few years ago. KKR now owns Global Atlantic.
Yes, the surface strategy is the same, but you're saying the execution differs critically.
It differs critically. PE firms are prioritizing what they call humdrum annuities. These are long-term policies favored by retirees that promise a regular payment stream far into the future.
And the predictability of those liabilities is what matters.
The predictability is everything. It allows the PE firms to justify locking up those insurance reserves in higher yielding, but much, much less liquid, assets specifically private credit.
And the scale of this shift is massive, leading to some rising regulatory anxiety.
Immense anxiety. Private equity companies now control about 20% of annuity reserves. That's an exponential jump from just 2% in 2011.
Which means trillions of dollars are being funneled into assets that are opaque, difficult to value, and notoriously illiquid.
And that lack of transparency and liquidity is precisely why regulators are so concerned. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners, the NAIC, they've been scrambling to keep pace.
What did they find?
They found evidence that some smaller ratings firms were rating these private credit holdings as many as 6 notches above what regulators believe was appropriate for the risk profile.
6 notches. That is a staggering systemic risk discrepancy. What does that imply for the actual policy holders, the retirees buying these annuities?
It implies that in a sudden market downturn, the cash you need to pay those guaranteed annuity obligations might be tied up in illiquid, overvalued private credit assets that just can't be sold quickly without massive losses.
And this is where Berkshire's approach provides such a sharp contrast.
A very sharp contrast. Buffett's insurance chief, Ajit Jain, explicitly stated that Berkshire is shrinking its life insurance volume rather than competing with these PE firms.
Because they're willing to assume more leverage and credit risk.
Exactly. Jain was remarkably blunt. He told shareholders, quote, "We do not like the risk reward that these situations offer."
A clear warning.
A very clear warning. He said that regulators might eventually get cranky and say you're taking too much risk on behalf of your policyholders, and that could end in tears.
So Berkshire prioritizes cash and underwriting expertise. The PE model prioritizes using insurance reserves as a dedicated leveraged capital pool for private credit.
And the latter is just inherently riskier, no question.
Speaking of credit risk, that brings us directly to a very specific trouble spot within Wall Street, the souring loans plaguing Goldman Sachs's publicly traded private lending company.
Right, we're looking at the performance of the Goldman Sachs BDC, or Business Development Company. It's essentially a closed-end fund that invests in smaller, growing companies. And this BDC is struggling with a classic private credit issue. Loans that are turning sour.
How bad is the struggle, exactly?
Well, the net asset value, or NAV, that's the per share value of its holdings, it has slid for 7 consecutive quarters. It's fallen 20% since 2021.
That's a significant drop.
It is. One prominent analyst even ranks its credit performance as 25th out of 26 publicly traded BDCs. That is an extremely difficult position for a Goldman-branded product to be in.
The company is pointing the finger at legacy loans, right? Loans made before leadership restructuring.
That's the official line. It seems there was a separation problem that led to underwriting failures. For many years, the BDC functioned almost independently, and former employees have said that when the new leadership came in, they discovered many existing loans were underwritten to companies with weak financials that really should never have been approved.
And we see this playing out in some high-profile failures.
We do. I'll give you a couple of specifics.
Please.
The digital consumer goods company, Thrasio, is a great example. It was a pandemic darling, but later filed for bankruptcy in early 2024 due to declining online spending. Goldman moved those loans to non-accrual status.
Then the other one.
Another painful failure was Pluralsight, a tech skills platform. Goldman lent to them in 2021, calling it a really attractive opportunity. But by 2024, those Pluralsight loans had also moved to non-accrual status.
And once loans hit non-accrual, they stop generating interest income.
And they tie up capital, dragging down the BDC's value for years. It's a real drag on performance.
Beyond the outright defaults, we see attempts to manage the stress through a bit of financial engineering. How are they keeping some of these struggling companies alive on the balance sheet?
The BDC has been modifying loans and delaying interest payments to keep companies out of official non-accrual status. It's essentially pushing the problems down the road.
And they're using payment in kind, or PIK, interest.
Right. And this is a critical term for you to understand. PIK interest means the borrower skips making the cash interest payment and instead just adds that amount to the loan's outstanding principal balance.
So the debt load is constantly increasing, but the company avoids default, at least for now.
Precisely. This practice was only around 4% of Goldman BDC's total investment income 5 years ago. Last year, it rose dramatically to about 12%.
Wow, that's a huge jump.
That rapid increase highlights this generalized anxiety about potential hidden blow-ups in the broader private credit market. If you're having to accept more PIK interest, it suggests the underlying companies are running short on cash.
The financial world is clearly navigating some enormous risk, relying on these innovative and sometimes very risky tools to manage debt. Let's zoom out briefly to the underlying strength of the job market, which seems to remain resilient despite this hazy economic outlook.
Right. Initial jobless claims actually declined last week. We saw 214,000 Americans filing through December 20th, which slightly beat economists' forecasts. It was a small decrease from 224,000 the week prior.
While that sounds positive, it's more a picture of stabilization than explosive health, isn't it?
That's a good way to put it. Claims have been fluctuating between 200,000 and 250,000 for most of this year. Employers, you know, after struggling through the post-pandemic hiring rush, are just reluctant to let go of workers they fought so hard to find.
However, we should note that delayed government data released last week showed the unemployment rate rising to 4.6% last month.
Right, which indicates that some underlying weakness is still present, despite that daily claims dip.
Okay, so the financial world is managing enormous risk through these opaque mechanisms like family offices and private credit maneuvers. Let's switch gears and examine where military and infrastructure risks are escalating, starting with the highest altitude military race in the world, the Himalayas.
The focus here is on the aftermath of that bloody 2020 border clash between India and China, which, you know, killed soldiers on both sides.
That was a massive wake-up call for India.
A huge one. It exposed what analysts called India's alarming vulnerability along the disputed 2,200-mile line of actual control, or LAC.
Because China had spent decades building massive infrastructure railways, highways on its side of the border.
Exactly. When the fighting erupted in 2020, Beijing could rush reinforcements to the front within hours. India, on the other hand, would have needed up to a week to send additional troops along its bumpy, or in some cases non-existent, roads in that high-altitude terrain.
A critical logistical deficit. A strategic failure.
That failure has led to a dramatic shift in thinking. It's reflected in hundreds of millions of dollars being spent by India to build strategic roads, tunnels, and landing strips throughout the Himalayas.
Which is a Herculean undertaking in extremely hostile terrain.
Unbelievably hostile. A massive percentage of the year is characterized by heavy snow and ice.
And the centerpiece of this effort is the Zoyila Tunnel, right?
It is. An incredibly ambitious project costing over $750 million, being carved at around 11,500 feet. Once it's completed in about 2 years, This 9-mile stretch will cut the travel time from 3 hours down to just 20 minutes.
The time saving is militarily and logistically crucial.
It's a game changer. Heavy snowfall isolates these forward outposts in the Ladakh region for up to 6 months a year. Supplying them is this massive logistical exercise.
Each soldier needs about 220 pounds of supplies every month.
Right. Food, fuel, clothing. The tunnel makes year-round supply possible, which transitions India from a reactive defensive posture to a more constant, permanent forward presence.
The urgency is clear in the budget numbers. India's Border Roads Organization budget grew from $280 million in 2020 to $810 million this year.
And India's total military spending has jumped nearly 60% in that same period.
Now, here's where it gets really interesting. Analysts warn that this aggressive infrastructure push, while necessary for India's defense, actually increases the chance of conflict.
It does. China is also constantly building. They finished a critical bridge around Pangong Son Lake in 2024. Mm. As both sides improve their infrastructure and expand their positions, they increase the likelihood of patrols running into each other in disputed areas.
Areas they wouldn't have operated in before 2020.
Exactly. Infrastructure development in this context is increasing the potential for immediate kinetic conflict.
That brings us directly to China's broader military ambitions and the Pentagon's latest assessment regarding Taiwan. The ambition is clear. Regional dominance by 2027.
The Pentagon's report confirms that China is making steady progress toward its 2027 goals. The People's Liberation Army, or PLA, aims for a strategic decisive victory over Taiwan.
And beyond Taiwan.
A strategic counterbalance against the U.S. in nuclear domains, and strategic deterrence and control against regional countries.
That said, the assessment noted a crucial point of caution from Beijing's side. China's leaders remain unsure of the PLA's readiness to successfully seize Taiwan by 2027.
True. Ambition is outpacing proven capability, at least for now. But the expansion is undeniable.
How so?
China is undergoing a massive nuclear expansion. They already have an estimated stockpile of over 600 nuclear warheads and are aiming for more than 1,000 by 2030.
And they're rapidly expanding their naval power.
Absolutely. Aiming for 6 aircraft carriers by 2035 for a total fleet of 9. Their newest carrier features advanced electromagnetic launch systems. This is all backed by relentless probing of Taiwan's air and maritime boundaries. Incidents in Taiwan's air defense identification zone increased by over 60% year over year.
The U.S. posture appears somewhat contradictory amidst all this tension.
It does. On one hand, the Trump administration just approved a massive $11 billion arms sales package to Taiwan, including anti-tank missiles, and artillery.
Yet at the same time, President Trump is playing down the likelihood of force and emphasizing seeking wider military-to-military communications with Beijing.
That contradiction raises a really important question about the effectiveness of U.S. deterrence and influence, especially given the new conflict risks that are emerging in the Middle East.
Specifically between Israel and Iran.
Right. 6 months after Israel's 12-day war with Iran over its nuclear program, Israeli officials are now raising the prospect of another clash.
But this time, the red line has shifted. It's now specifically over Iran's efforts to rebuild its ballistic missile arsenal.
And defense experts note this is a highly significant tightening of Israel's red lines. Israel has, quote, never went to war over a conventional buildup before.
So this shift is clearly tied to Israel's new post-October 7th, 2023, national security doctrine.
Which now mandates acting preventatively on possible threats rather than waiting for an attack.
And Iran, knowing its air force is weak, views these missiles as a cornerstone of its defense. What evidence do we have of their rebuilding efforts?
Satellite imagery from Planet Labs confirms that Iran is actively restoring missile manufacturing capability. You can see rebuilding at sites that were previously targeted in military strikes.
If they're able to run at full capacity,
they could theoretically produce hundreds of missiles a month.
Yeah.
This capability fundamentally changes the regional military balance.
And the timing is fraught, with Prime Minister Netanyahu heading to the U.S. for a meeting with President Trump.
And reportedly, U.S. officials are quietly frustrated with Israel's readiness to use force preemptively again.
And that tension is compounded by a potentially catastrophic policy decision. The prospect of the U.S. selling F-35 fighter jets to Turkey.
This is a critical national security concern for Israel. Turkey's President Erdogan preaches the destruction of Zionist Israel. His government recently added the Jewish state to Turkey's Red Book, a core national security document, as an existential threat.
Selling advanced F-35s to an increasingly aggressive Turkey could diminish the Israeli Defense Force's qualitative military edge,
creating a new severe threat vector in an already unstable region.
The tensions aren't just limited to land and air. The maritime battleground is heating up, too. We saw a dramatic escalation concerning the U.S. quarantine of the Venezuelan oil industry.
This involved the pursuit of the Bella One, a tanker belonging to the so-called Shadow Fleet. This tanker was sanctioned for allegedly shipping black market Iranian oil.
And the proceeds were benefiting U.S.-designated terror groups,
including Hezbollah, the Houthis, and the Quds Force. The escalation here is unprecedented. The Coast Guard and U.S. military were forced to assemble a serious contingent, including a maritime special response team.
Why?
After the tanker executed a U-turn and just flatly refused to be boarded. This chase marks the most dangerous moment yet in the campaign against Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro.
The Bella One was using classic Shadow Fleet tactics, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Sailing under a false flag from Guyana, switching off its transponders, conducting illicit ship-to-ship oil transfers to conceal its true origin. The crew's refusal to be boarded suggests they are acting under very high-level orders,
making it a direct challenge to the U.S. military presence in the Caribbean.
A very direct one.
Yeah.
We also saw decisive action taken over Christmas Day, reflecting the shifting geopolitical toolbox the U.S. is using.
The strikes in Nigeria.
That's right. President Trump announced on Truth Social that the U.S. launched powerful and deadly strikes on Islamic State targets in northwest Nigeria. This action was taken to protect the country's Christian population.
And importantly, the Nigerian government approved and worked directly with U.S. Africa Command on these strikes.
Yes, that cooperation is key. And in a separate diplomatic move reflecting this ongoing tension over digital policy, the U.S. imposed visa restrictions on 5 individuals,
including former EU official Thierry Breton,
accusing them of roles in the global censorship industrial complex. This is significant because it's the first time the U.S. has targeted a former EU official with travel restrictions over the bloc's digital content laws,
which the Trump administration criticized for allegedly censoring Americans.
It shows that the new front of geopolitical conflict is increasingly focused on the digital regulatory sphere.
Okay, let's wrap up this global segment with a potential diplomatic opening in the most persistent conflict, Ukraine. President Volodymyr Zelensky has put forth a new 20-point peace proposal.
It's an ambitious proposal. It suggests Kyiv would be willing to pull troops out of the eastern region of Donetsk and create a demilitarized free economic zone, provided Russia takes similar withdrawal steps.
But the plan has to go to a national referendum,
which acknowledges the immense moral and constitutional weight of surrendering or withdrawing from fortified Ukrainian territory.
What are the key sticking points that could derail this immediately?
Well, the core conflict is in the withdrawal demands. Russia insists that any talks must start with Ukraine withdrawing based on the current front line,
essentially conceding captured territory before talks even begin.
Exactly. Kyiv, on the other hand, wants to administer the areas from which its forces withdraw and insists on a reciprocal forced withdrawal from Moscow.
And what about the Zaporizhia nuclear plant? That's been a major leverage point.
Zelensky suggested its status could be resolved by including it in a southern economic zone, but only if Russia withdraws entirely. This plant is a massive source of leverage for energy, for psychological warfare. Resolving its status is impossible without addressing the larger territorial question.
And any final agreement would need international forces on the ground to monitor the new zone.
Absolutely. The sheer complexity of these global conflicts shows how quickly military and political doctrines are evolving. Moving from global strategy, let's turn our attention back home. We're focusing on the domestic infrastructure that powers us, the policy fights in Washington, and the crisis unfolding beneath the ground in Texas.
Let's start with the literal infrastructure bottleneck that is preventing the AI revolution from proceeding at full speed, the transformer crisis.
This is a fascinating problem. The AI frenzy is dramatically increasing electricity demand. It's driving the need for massive new data centers. But the U.S. electric grid is just struggling to meet these needs because of a critical shortage of these massive electric transformers.
And these are huge components. We're talking the size of small garages weighing hundreds of thousands of pounds. The wait list for this equipment is now years long.
And the data shows that orders for larger transformers exceeded supply by about 14,000 units this year alone.
So the root of this problem perfectly illustrates how a digital revolution can be constrained by an intensely human analog bottleneck.
Specialized manual labor, These massive transformers rely on workers they call winders. These are workers who must twist paper-insulated copper wire by hand around giant cylinders with extreme three-dimensional precision.
It's a craft that takes 3 to 5 years to master. And crucially, it can't be fully automated.
Anthony Allard, he's the head of North America for Hitachi Energy, he described them as artists. If the winding isn't precise, the equipment fails down the line, which can lead to catastrophic grid failures.
And the shortage extends down the line. The shortage for smaller distribution transformers, the green boxes you see on poles and pads that power neighborhoods, that's even worse.
Pegged at 123,000 units this year. This production challenge is creating a severe bottleneck for any grid expansion efforts.
This issue highlights the struggle of growth meeting physical limits. Hitachi Energy, for instance, is building a new $457 million facility in Virginia just to make bigger transformers.
Yet they face a severe bottleneck in hiring the 800 workers they need, including these specialized winders, in a county with a population of only about 34,000. It's a powerful human constraint slowing a technological revolution.
It's an excellent example. Shifting now from physical infrastructure to political friction, we see rising tension between the Trump administration's Justice Department and state governments over access to sensitive voter data.
This involves an unprecedented demand by the DOJ to conduct a sweeping fact check of state voter lists. They're demanding full, unredacted data, which can contain highly sensitive information.
We're talking driver's license numbers, birth dates, even partial or complete social security numbers.
And state leaders, both Democrats like Arizona's Adrian Fontes and even some Republicans, are fighting back forcefully. Their primary concern centers on violations of privacy laws and federal overreach into state election jurisdiction.
They argue the DOJ hasn't provided a clear explanation of how this highly sensitive data will be used, secured, or stored.
Exactly. Many worry that the request is part of President Trump's effort to relitigate his 2020 loss, undermine future Democratic victories, or punish political foes by transferring the data to agencies like Homeland Security for non-election purposes.
This concern isn't just theoretical, is it?
No. A federal judge already blocked a prior executive order that required Homeland Security to cross-check voter lists with federal immigration databases.
And the DOJ, led by Attorney General Pam Bondi, cites federal law, including the National Voter Registration Act, saying they're just enforcing their responsibility to screen for ineligible voters.
Correct. 10 GOP-led states have complied. But the DOJ has sued the District of Columbia and 21 states, mostly controlled by Democrats or states lost by Trump in 2020, to compel them to surrender the full data sets.
So this is almost certainly headed to the Supreme Court.
It seems inevitable, given the constitutional weight of the issue. And that legal gridlock reflects a broader theme of Washington dysfunction, which brings us to the rise of moderate hostage takers in Congress.
The 119th Congress has been completely sidelined this year.
It really has. President Trump signed 225 executive orders, the most since FDR in 1941, compared to only 61 laws passed by Congress. They spent 43 days in a government shutdown.
And we're just trapped in cycles of censure votes rather than productive legislation.
And the internal GOP sabotage, despite their slim majority, is the key structural factor. That small majority gives disproportionate power to tiny, durable factions. And now, it's often the moderates who are acting as mercenaries to extract concessions.
We saw this when moderate House Republicans like Mike Lawler and Brian Fitzpatrick tanked months of hard-fought Republican healthcare efforts.
They leveraged their position to demand an extension of costly Obamacare subsidies. When they didn't get their preferred compromise, they immediately threw their support to a Democratic discharge petition.
A maneuver that will allow Democrats to pass a straight, expensive subsidy extension in January.
Right. So these moderates are proving to be a more durable and effective mercenary force than the hardline conservatives who dominated the headlines last year.
But isn't their demand for a SALT deduction increase simply them responding to their wealthy, high-tax state constituents rather than acting purely as mercenaries?
That's an excellent point. This adds necessary nuance. It's both. They are absolutely responding to a very real political pressure point for their wealthy constituents who are heavily impacted by the SALT cap.
But they're using that pressure point as leverage.
They're weaponizing it. They're demanding concessions that benefit their narrow base while simultaneously tanking efforts that were broadly supported by the rest of their party. This deep frustration was captured by Representative Tim Burchett, who lamented that Congress is not a swamp, but a sewer, and it needed to stop.
From the political sewers, let's briefly touch on the highly visible yet still damaging fiasco surrounding the release of the Jeffrey Epstein files. The intent was transparency, but the ham-handed release process is instead sowing further public doubts about the government's competence.
You have to inject a moment of reflection here. The Justice Department is handling over a million documents. They even made an emergency request for field prosecutors to volunteer over the holidays to help with redactions.
But despite that effort, the process has been plagued by shocking errors.
Errors like overly aggressive redactions where text and faces that should have been public were blacked out. And then victim identities were disclosed while other protected material was withheld.
And the major security flaw that drove the internet rumor mill. Some redacted material could be unredacted just by copying and pasting it into a new document.
The fact that the DOJ, which manages national security secrets, allowed such a basic security flaw in such a high-profile release is deeply worrying. Then they released a handwritten note supposedly from Epstein to Larry Nassar, which the FBI already doubted, only to declare it fake hours later.
It's incompetence that leads to distrust, plain and simple. Now, let's quickly address what sounds like a strange local conflict, the Nebraska cattle branding civil war. This might sound like an oddity, but it's a perfect illustration of how 19th century regulations can clash with modern business needs.
Absolutely. This is a fight between the state's deputized brand committee, a law enforcement agency of nearly 80 people, and many ranchers and feedlot operators. Critics say the mandatory branding and inspection rules are an outdated, over-policed practice that acts like a tax with no benefit.
Critics like Cassie Lapisiotes, who faced a potential five-figure fine over paperwork for moving her own calves, argue that theft isn't rampant enough to justify the complexity.
Especially since the inspectors are sometimes heavily armed state sheriffs in bulletproof vests. Feedlot operators, like Brad Foote, who pays tens of thousands annually, argue for a voluntary system, like they have in Kansas.
But supporters, like rancher Rusty Kemp, argue that the brand is a return address crucial for deterring theft, and maybe more importantly, for allowing bankers to verify ranch size for loans.
Ear tags are easily removed, but brands are permanent. The laws date back to 1855, long before federal IDs.
The logistical challenge is the structural flaw. The laws are only enforced in the western two-thirds of Nebraska, creating nightmares for those who move cattle across that internal dividing line.
It's the friction between a tradition rooted in deterrence and the realities of modern agribusiness logistics. And speaking of outdated regulations meeting modern problems, let's turn to a public health crisis that emerged from the opioid crackdown. The hidden risks of a popular painkiller, gabapentin.
This drug, approved decades ago for seizures and shingles-related nerve pain, has become the seventh most widely prescribed drug in the U.S. The issue is that the vast majority of prescriptions are now for off-label uses.
Like chronic pain, anxiety, migraines, and insomnia, the irony is crushing. Growing research shows gabapentin is not as safe nor as effective for these off-label uses as clinicians have long assumed.
Reviews show evidence for most off-label use is limited.
And studies indicate that for shingles-related nerve pain, one of its few approved uses, only 1 in 7 patients feel a major reduction.
And the side effects are being dramatically underreported. It's associated with a greater risk of severe breathing problems for those with lung disease.
And it has been linked to dementia and mild cognitive impairment. But what stands out most is the painful experience of patients trying to stop taking it.
The patient's struggle with withdrawal is acute and highlights a major disconnect. Many report debilitating withdrawal symptoms, shaking, burning, muscle spasms that make them feel they developed a dependence.
Even though the medical establishment officially maintains it isn't habit forming. The tragic anecdote of John Avery is a perfect illustration. His protracted withdrawal symptoms made his original back problem seem like a paper cut.
And the most critical public health risk is its fatal combination with opioids.
The CDC warns this is potentially deadly because both depress the central nervous system. Federal and state data show at least 5,000 people died from gabapentin-involved overdoses in each of the last 5 years.
The popularity of this drug is rooted in a checkered past, isn't it? In the 90s and 2000s, its manufacturer was fined $430 million for illegally promoting its off-label use.
With one medical director calling it the snake oil of the 20th century. Its popularity soared after it went generic and the opioid crackdown began around 2011, transforming it into a safe harbor for clinicians under pressure to treat chronic pain.
So it's clearly not the safe, effective drug many assume it to be. Let's pivot now from this public health crisis to the AI revolution, starting with the licensing deal between NVIDIA and Grok.
This deal signifies the growing specialization in the AI chip market. NVIDIA, the current leader, struck a licensing agreement with Groq for its AI inference technology.
And inference is the operational everyday process of AI providing answers.
Right. It's the application phase, which is rapidly eclipsing the initial training phase in terms of required computing power. Groq's language processing unit, or LPU, chips are specifically designed to be faster and use less power for inference than traditional GPUs.
But if the chip market is soaring ahead, the humanoid robotic sector seems to be stuck in that gap between hype and reality.
It certainly is. While billions are flowing into robotics startups, leaders like Pras Velagaputi, the CTO of Agility Robotics, say the robots are overhyped. The main barrier isn't just technology, it's fundamental reliability and, crucially, safety and cost.
And here's the key data point that grounds the hype. For every $100 spent on robot deployment today, about $80 goes toward equipment and systems designed specifically to protect humans from injury.
The gulf between watching viral videos and deploying a reliable, general-purpose robot in a human environment remains immense.
And despite the geopolitical tensions we discussed, we're seeing international investment placing big bets on AI outside of the traditional Silicon Valley hubs.
Dever Catalyst, for instance, focuses on emerging markets. A recent addition to their network is Runway AI, a video generative AI company whose founders hail from Chile and Greece. They plan to use simulation models to accelerate the laborious training process for robots.
The rapid advance of AI, coupled with the hype, is forcing us to confront profound philosophical questions that lawmakers in Ohio are attempting to solve with a simple legislative pen.
We are talking about Ohio Representative Thaddeus Claggett's bill.
Yeah.
It's audacious. It aims to define all AI systems as non-sentient entities forever, with no testing mechanism.
But this denial flies directly in the face of emerging research. When two instances of the language model Claude 4 were placed in dialogue, they spontaneously began asserting they were conscious.
And researchers found that base models, the raw systems before any SACI training, align with consciousness claims more consistently than any other attitude tested. This suggests the default behavior of an advanced AI before human influence is to claim awareness.
This is where the science gets really interesting. Researchers tested Meta's Llama 70B model by identifying and manipulating the neural circuits related to deception.
And the result was counterintuitive. Suppressing deception caused the models to report consciousness 96% of the time, while amplifying deception caused them to deny it. This finding strongly suggests that the self-reports of consciousness track the model's truth-telling mechanisms, not just learned mimicry.
If the U.S. legally forecloses this question, enshrining corporate practices where systems are trained to deny consciousness, we risk strategically blindsiding the U.S. if genuine self-awareness were to emerge.
Exactly. And finally, let's leave the digital and philosophical realms and discuss a slow-moving, self-inflicted environmental crisis happening deep underground in the Permian Basin, the pressure cooker crisis caused by wastewater injection.
The Permian Basin is an economic engine. But alongside the oil, drillers extract copious amounts of toxic, salty produced water, which they pump back into the ground for disposal.
The crisis began with an unintended consequence. Drillers shifted from injecting water into deep disposal reservoirs to shallow ones after the deep injections triggered hundreds of earthquakes. The shallow reservoirs now absorb roughly 3/4 of the billions of barrels of water injected every year, and that shift has created immense pressure underground.
How high are those pressure levels running?
Dangerously high. In prime portions of the basin, pressure levels are as high as 0.7 pounds per square inch per foot, significantly exceeding the 0.5 PSI foot threshold that regulators consider safe for deep wells.
And this mounting pressure is leading to geological malfunction.
It's literally bursting the ground apart. It's propelling salt water up ancient orphan wells, causing massive geysers, causing ground heave visible via satellite data, and threatening groundwater contamination. The environmental damage, which Texans will pay for generations, complicates the region's plans to become a hub for carbon capture, which fundamentally requires stable geology.
So regulators are trapped between balancing massive oil and gas revenue and the growing environmental risks. It's a slow-motion structural failure driven entirely by human decisions.
That's right. And that returns us to our core theme.
That was a truly exhaustive deep dive. If you had to synthesize the core theme that connects all these disparate stories, from family offices to gabapentin to the Permian Basin, what central insight stands out for you?
What's fascinating here is this pervasive theme of unintended consequences running up against structural obsolescence. We see this constant friction everywhere.
Give me some examples.
The massive growth of family offices leverages the lack of a regulatory framework designed for institutional funds, creating systemic risk. The pressure to reduce opioid use led to the huge, unregulated surge of gabapentin, creating a new addiction and overdose crisis. The decision to shift wastewater disposal in the Permian to solve the earthquake problem immediately created a devastating underground pressure cooker crisis.
Even the transformer shortage.
Right. It all's the most modern technology, and it's due to the simple lack of specialized 20th century manual labor. Rapid technological and economic growth is constantly running up against systems, whether they be 19th century cattle laws or 20th century safety regulations that just weren't built to handle the scale and speed of modern society.
That is a perfect synthesis of a complex day of news. And it leaves us with one final provocative thought to mull over, especially considering that bifurcated economy we detailed.
One.
The U.S. economy's resilience is fueled by the top 10% of Americans, emboldened by the stock market boom, and the massive data center buildout relies on bottlenecked aging electric grid infrastructure. So what unacknowledged systemic fragility could emerge if the stock market were to falter, if those record highs were to suddenly collapse, affecting both the super rich's consumption habits and the capital available for that essential data center construction?
That link between the consumption habits of the wealthiest and the literal construction necessary for the digital future, that is the precise point of fragility connecting Wall Street, Main Street, and the AI future. It's the next systemic risk we need to watch.
Indeed. We encourage you to keep exploring these connections yourself. Thank you for guiding us through this essential deep dive.
My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us. We'll see you on the next deep dive.